Good evening. Welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Sarah Holliday, Library Events Coordinator. As we begin, may I remind you please to silence cell phones or anything that might disrupt the event. We appreciate it. It's my pleasure this evening to introduce a good friend of this library, Ellen Feldman, and her recent book, The Unwitting. Since this library was already in this building and 200 years old at the time her book takes place in the 1950s and 60s, I did a little hunting to see what related reading our members were doing then. I popped a few volumes on the table over there if you want to take a look. Our oldest book on the Cold War is, somewhat to my surprise, actually called The Cold War, and it's from 1947 by Walter Lippmann. The OED lists this title as the third major use of the term since its evident coining by no less a writer than George Orwell in 1945. That's the OED on the fly. It's probably arguable, but that's what they say. By 1950, Ellis M. Zacharias was already claiming to have documented the secret history of the Cold War in a book called Behind Closed Doors. He didn't know it was going to go on for some considerable time. That's over there, too. By 1960, the term is commonplace in books by John Lukacs, Harry Hal Ransom, and, interestingly, Edmund Wilson. And I'm sure our patrons were also reading the Paris Review. But if you only read one book about the Cold War these days, read The Unwitting by Ellen Feldman. In fact, our colleagues from the Corner Bookstore would be delighted to sell you a copy following the event. Ellen is a person we're always happy to see at the desk or on the fifth floor here, and we're honored that the library has had a small part in supporting her outstanding work. Please join me in welcoming Ellen Feldman.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm not surprised that you did your homework. I actually thought that Walter Lippmann came before Orwell in coining the phrase, but they're both referred to. But thank you for that warm welcome, and thank you all for coming out tonight to hear about dirty books, but not the kind that we usually think of when we use that term. About a year and a half ago, James Clapper, the director of National Intelligence, was asked during a congressional hearing if the National Security Agency had been collecting data on millions of Americans. He answered, not wittingly. The public was, they thought he was joking. He was serious. The CIA Insider's Dictionary, and I'm not so sure how inside it is, because although it's not here, you can go down to the public library and file a slip, and you can become a CIA insider. And the Insider's Dictionary lists someone who is witting as someone who knows about the intelligence connection to the operation. Someone who is unwitting, it's pretty obvious, is someone who is in the dark about the fact that he's working for the, he or she is working for the CIA or another intelligence organization. We'll come back to that distinction a little later. Writers have always been spies, metaphorically, of course, but frequently, actually, as well. Somerset Maugham, Graham Greene, John le Carré, and William F. Buckley, Jr., all worked for their respective intelligence organizations. Peter Matheson, as a young man in Paris, desperate for any way to stay on in Paris and finish his first book, worked for the CIA. Later, he would say that it was, of all the escapades he got up to during his adventurous life, it was the only one he really regretted. John O'Hara applied to the CIA, to work for the CIA as a young man, but he was turned down. I haven't been able to find out why he was turned down. It cannot have been because of his drinking, because heavy drinking was almost a prerequisite for working for the CIA, and the only group that drank more was UK, then Great Britain's MI6. It was pretty heavy. They were both pretty heavy drinking crowds. But if writing and spying seem to go hand in hand, publishers tend more to the tweed and pipe, and more to tweed and pipe than cloak and dagger stereotype, at least in the public imagination. But when the CIA opened a second front in the Cold War, known as the Cultural Cold War, which would be fought not with bullets and bombs, but with words and ideas, the publishing industry secretly, and that's the operative word here, secretly took up arms, or at least words, on the agency's behalf. A bit of background here. By the early 1950s, late 40s even, in 1950s, Western Europe, India, Southeast Asia, and various newly minted post-colonial nations of Africa were growing increasingly anti-American. Yanks, who had been liberators right after the war, were now seen as too rich, because we were the only nation that came out of the war prosperous, too rich, too crass, too pushy, too full of themselves in their new role on the international scene. Meanwhile, the Soviet Union was making great strides in these same places because especially the emerging countries, were very poor, and the Soviet Union promised a better future. Therefore, it was a struggle for the hearts and minds of the people. And for this, the CIA's usual methods, and they were not known then as much of small wars, revolutions, dirty tricks, would not work. The CIA needed persuasive propaganda. The logical place to turn, they thought, was the publishing industry. Now, you might think that movies would be more logical because, of course, movies they're more popular around the world and people don't have to know English. But the movie industry never needed money the way publishing always does. And they did make occasional inroads. The CIA made occasional inroads into the movie industry. They finally persuaded one screenwriter to introduce a few African-American characters in the movie who would not be servants or minstrel men or anything like this. They would just be small characters in it. And this was important because one of the cudgels that the Soviet Union used against America in those days was our racial problems, you know, understandably. So the screenwriter wrote these characters in, and the movie played abroad, but they found out in the South it wouldn't play. In fact, the movies refused to screen that, theaters refused to screen that movie. So this was a real problem, playing at home and playing abroad. The South's response suggests one of the many ironies of the cultural Cold War. Another was the strange bedfellows it made. In order for the CIA's propaganda to be persuasive, it had to be left-leaning. During the McCarthy period, nobody wanted right-wing anti-communism. We had enough of it, is what it amounted to. And the people that the CIA was trying to persuade needed left-leaning articles and books, that sort of thing. CIA had no place to turn but the former communists and fellow travelers from the 30s. So this led to strange bedfellows. We had the CIA, the old Yale-y, old boy group, CIA, cooperating with the left-leaning, I'm trying to think the, okay, City College, okay, I lost City College, with the left-leaning City College intellectual Jews. So this was a very strange group that got together, but they got along for a good deal of the part. The role of the little magazines like Matheson's and George Plimpton's Paris Review in the cultural Cold War has been brooded about for a long time. But the book publishers, the role of the book publishers is largely unknown. In 1961, the chief of the CIA's covert action staff wrote, "Books differ from all other propaganda. One single book can significantly change the reader's attitude and action to an extent unmatched by the impact of any other single medium. Books are the most important weapon of strategic long-range propaganda." How strange this sounds today in the era of 140-character communications and in social media. However, according to the Pussy Riot, books still matter, especially in prison. So they were not quite, off the mark there. During the 50s and 60s, it was not unusual for someone to turn up, for an old friend, often from wartime, to turn up in the office of a publisher and say, "Would you like to do something for your country?" He didn't have to say what this something would be, because the fear was so widespread and the enemy was so agreed upon that this meant publishing articles and books promoting American interests and thwarting Soviet interests, or at least what were thought to be American interests and Soviet interests. Roger Strauss Jr. For R. Strauss Jr. writes in his oral history, of an old friend coming into his office and asking if he would let two CIA agents pose as scouts, European scouts, buying books. And he said, Strauss said, he felt it was his patriotic duty to say yes. This leads to another interesting footnote to this. It's a good indicator of how the CIA was viewed in the early post-war years. The CIA, of course, grew out of the OSS, and the OSS was one of the heroes of the war. So people were still, very, very admiring of the CIA. Only later on, when the dirty tricks and the small revolutions became known, and when Vietnam tore apart the country, did the CIA lose its luster. While I was doing the research for this, I had an interesting example of this, or maybe only of my age and prejudices. But I was told by a mutual, another person I knew, had been a CIA agent. And I said, am I allowed to know that? He said, yes. So I have been sitting, for 3 years, I've been sitting on a committee with this man, the former agent, and I did not know about him. And I went up to him before a meeting, and I said, I understand that you, and then I stopped dead. I couldn't say, we're a CIA agent, because to me that would be an insult. And I said, I dropped my voice and I said, cooperated with the CIA. He's a big man, he's 91 at the time, and he stepped back, he threw out his arms, he said, cooperated? I was Berlin bureau chief. And it was a very telling, a very instructive experience for me, because I came of age in an era when, you know, we marched against Vietnam, not that I did very much, but I mean, so we thought differently of the CIA. But back to the proposition to the publisher. If the publisher said yes, he, and in those days it was always a he, became witting. Everyone else in the publishing house or at the magazine was unwitting. According to a series of New York Times exposés in December 1977, not unlike the investigative reports of current NSA excesses, nearly a dozen mainstream publishing houses, including Doubleday, Scribner's, Ballantyne, G.P. Putnam Sons, and Prager, published books covertly funded by the CIA. These were not books that editors thought would be literary or commercial successes. In fact, the chief of the CIA's covert action staff went on to make clear that these books should be published for operational reasons, regardless of commercial viability. And here's the crucial part, should not be contaminated by any overt tie-in with the U.S. government. So it was propaganda, pure and simple. Of the more than 1,000 books published in the two decades, backed by the CIA, financed by the CIA, in the two decades after the war, more than a quarter of them were published in English. Many of them were published, obviously, in foreign language, were published in English, and either published here or excerpted here. Now, it's against, and I said they were propaganda, pure and simple. It is against the law for the U.S. government to propagandize the American people. The money from the CIA came in terms of guarantees of advances, of distribution, or sales. Often the books themselves were written by CIA agents. Fodor employed a lot of CIA agents, and Fodor always said that their affiliation did not color their reports on the country. Now, possibly they didn't color where you should go to dine, but they certainly covered the history of the country. E. Howard Hunt wrote in his memoir, Undercover, that Fawcett offered, quote, what was then an unheard of guarantee for a series of mysteries. Publishers speak of advances against royalties, not or against earnings, not guarantees. I think Hunt knew this, and I think he was having a good time in his memoir and teasing us all. In 1965, Doubleday brought out a book called The Penkovsky Papers, which purported to be a journal kept by Colonel Oleg Penkovsky, a Soviet double agent, in the months before he was caught, tried, and executed. Well, it was actually compiled by CIA agents from their own files. As one agency official observed later, spies rarely keep diaries. And I spoke to another agent recently while I was doing the research, and he told me that he had received a memo asking for contributions to this book. And when he went to the office where he was supposed to file the information, they denied having sent out a memo ever. So even their own agents were not trusted. James Michener worked for the CIA, and his books were, in fact, commercially successful, obviously. I don't know the big blockbusters of Michener's later career, so I don't know how CIA infiltrated they were, colored. The only one I know is Tales of the South Pacific, and what I remember of that, I think, would not appeal to CIA ends. But anyway, and that was right after the war, so he may have started to work for them later. In 1962, Coward McCann and Gahagan published Escape from Red China, which was written, again, entirely by CIA personnel and reviewed in the New York Times by a professor who was under contract to the agency. Gehagan, like the executives at Doubleday, as well as those at Scribner's, Ballantyne's, and G.P. Putnam's Sons, all claimed to be unwitting. Obviously, they didn't use the term. They didn't know about it. They said they knew nothing about the CIA connection. The little magazines were even more deeply penetrated and widely penetrated by the CIA. William Phillips of the Partisan Review went to his grave insisting he had never cooperated with the CIA. And while he was alive, he threatened to sue anybody who suggested that he had. But in fact, records reveal that a lot of money flowed to the Partisan Review through CIA front foundations. The British American magazine Encounter was wholly a function, wholly made up by the CIA and MI6. Stephen Spender, the British editor, was paid by MI6, and Irving Kristol was paid by the CIA. Later, Spender would insist that he had never known that MI6 was behind it, and his wife said that he was a good choice because he was so easily bamboozable. But I think Kristol did know, and I think I know Kristol knew. I mean, I'm assuming Kristol knew, and I think he admitted it later. Others were more perceptive or at least suspicious of Encounter. T.S. Eliot refused to contribute to it when he was asked, and others refused to even have it on their coffee table because they said it was so obviously a product of American propaganda. Thus, an effort in transatlantic cooperation ended up fueling British anti-Americanism, which, like the rest of Western Europe, was pretty strong at the time. However, not all the writers were immune to CIA brandishments, because there were a lot of jokes going around about expensive Soho lunches that American taxpayers were footing the bill for. Journalists were another group who enlisted in the cultural Cold War. A CIA agent once went to Philip Graham, the publisher of the Washington Post, and asked how much it would cost to hire a reporter to peddle CIA propaganda. And Graham responded, "Oh, not much at all. Less than you'd have to pay a good hooker a month." Zig Mikkelsen, head of CBS News, head of CBS News, got so tired of having to run down to the street to call the CIA that he had a phone installed in his office that bypassed the switchboard and went straight to the CIA. So this went to pretty high levels. But a big problem with the journalists was blowback, because many papers in this country were picking up news from foreign correspondents, from reporters, from the AP, that sort of thing, and many of these stories were being filed by CIA reporters on the CIA payroll. So once again, I say it's against the law to propagandize the American people, and this may have been happening inadvertently, but it definitely was happening. This gets even more peculiar. The CIA's enlistment of the art world in the battle against the communist specter has been rumored for some time, but just recently, a former case officer, Donald Jameson, broke the silence and said, yes, the CIA did espouse abstract expressionism. It was the perfect school of art for them, because it, against Soviet realism, and it wasn't hard to go up against Soviet realism, which was so grim, this was an expression of free American individuality, and it was supposed to be kind of tougher and more American than the old masters. It was, in fact, thought to be uniquely American, and Nelson Rockefeller, the president of MoMA at the time, called it free enterprise painting, which I love. The CIA focused on Jackson Pollock as the perfect American art hero. He was fast driving, heavy drinking, cowboy boot wearing, and he painted from the hip, they said. Now, I'm not suggesting that Jackson Pollock ever knew about the CIA backing promotion of a lot of his work. And in fact, as Jameson, the agent who came out with the information recently, quote, "If you had to use people who consider themselves in one way or another to be closer to Moscow than Washington, well, so much the better." So I think they were, obviously, this was very useful to them. But here's another irony of this. While the CIA, the agents were pretty sophisticated intellectually and artistically, Congress, Presidents Truman and Eisenhower, and the American people hated modern art. In 1947, the State Department organized a traveling show called Advancing American Art. The public, when they found out of it, was outraged. One congressman went on record saying, "I am just a dumb American who pays taxes for this kind of trash." But my favorite is President Truman, who said, "If that's art, then I'm a Hottentot." The tour was canceled. The show was canceled. And Tom Braden, who was a CIA department chief, came out with a wonderful justification for the covert funding of all this. Quote, "It takes a pope or somebody with a lot of money to recognize art and support it. And after many centuries, people say, oh, look, the Sistine Chapel, the most beautiful creation on earth." So his argument was that the CIA was funding this art covertly, not because the CIA was not supposed to be doing it, but because the American people couldn't appreciate art, but the government could. So the CIA could be creative in many, many ways. The issue of who was witting and who was unwitting remains in question to this day. As one CIA officer explained, relationships were entered into with promises of eternal confidentiality. Matheson's confession that this was the greatest regret of his life never should have happened. The line between witting and unwitting was even dicier for many of the writers than it was for the publishers. While some were under contract, as I said, to the CIA itself, others may well have been really unwitting. An agency directive stated, our control over the writer will have to be enforced, usually by paying him or at least advancing him sums which he might have to repay. Chilling words to a writer. And a writer actually would not necessarily know where the advance was coming from, because unless the check was cut on the CIA, and it certainly wasn't. It was a front organization, then paying the publisher, then paying the writer. I have another reason to be sympathetic to these poor writers who might have been willfully unwitting. None of us wants to think that we're being published not for the book's excellence, but for its political expediency. So it's very easy to fool ourselves. And in fact, the CIA gave first-rate treatment to a lot of second-rate writers while working very hard to suppress writers like Faulkner, Steinbeck, and Richard Wright, who showed what the CIA thought of as the seamy side of American life. Relations between those who cooperated and those who refused to cooperate sometimes got ugly. Again, while I was doing research, I spoke to a very well-known biographer now who was a newspaper reporter at the day, and he said he was approached by the CIA, and he knew what was happening, and he said, no, thank you. Years later, he discovered that a good friend had, in fact, cooperated with the CIA, and he stopped talking to him completely, just cut him. So these passions ran deep, and a commentary on this is the quote from E.M. Forster's Two Cheers for Democracy, which serves as an epigraph to the unwitting, my book. Quote, "If I had to choose between betraying my country and betraying my friend, I hope I should have the guts to betray my country." It was a difficult time. The changing of the definition of loyalty and betrayal was one of the inspirations for my writing of The Unwitting, which is a novel about a husband and wife caught up in this maelstrom of conflicted loyalties and ethical ambiguities. In a conversation with a friend whose father disappeared right immediately post, in the post-war years during an intelligence flight, she told me that the Navy stonewalled her for years in trying to get information about this. It was a time when both government acts and personal life was kept secret. Sex was hush-hush. Agencies were hush-hush, this sort of thing. The true patriot, not to mention the discreet individual, kept secrets. Nowadays, secrets are a thing of the past, and patriotism means spilling the beans. With hindsight, these clandestine collusions between an arm of an intelligence agency devoted to propaganda and dirty tricks and men and women sworn to the authenticity of the written word would appear shabby, if not shocking. It's difficult now to imagine the mindset of those Cold War years. A mushroom-shaped cloud hung over the national consciousness. We were assured that the Soviet Union was as sure that we were determined to start a third world war as we were sure that they were determined to start a third world war. As Alan Dulles said, the head of the CIA then, of course, explained in a 1967 television interview, "Our methods were appropriate for the situation we found ourselves in. In other words, if the Soviets played dirty, we had to as well." But how far can a democracy go to preserve a democratic way of life before it ceases to be a democracy? Half a century later, we're still debating an answer to that question. And now I hope you all have lots of questions. Yes, Jim. Doesn't an agent always try to keep unwitting people under him? I have a feeling you know more about this than I do, and I won't ask your affiliation. I guess with real spies, yes, with real agents out there in the field. I think this was when the CIA began to deal with the publishing industry. I think it was so much an old boys network. I mean, I talked about the strange bedfellows of the Jewish intellectual mafia in New York. But in fact, when it got to a lot of the publishing houses and the little magazines, I think it was very much people who knew each other from the war and people who knew each other perhaps from school. And I think you didn't really have to be very clear about things. You could say, you know, we're interested in... One of the arguments with this little magazines was, we're not paying you for propaganda. We're just paying you to say what you want to say anyway. And when this got colored is something else, and how much the publishers began to censor themselves is, you know, we'll never know. Yes? My book is fiction, but it's based on this research. And there are some real characters in it, but the main protagonists are fictional. Yes? It's so funny, with the exception of one book, I can never say exactly where the idea came from, and this one I can't say exactly. As I said, the idea that secrets, the 50s were a very secretive time, it seems to me. You know, everything was hush-hush, everything was swept under the rug. And as I said, I was talking to this friend, and what's happening with, I mean, we bemoan our lack of privacy, we bemoan kids going public with their most personal goings-on, doings, and it struck me as a very strange change. I, in fact, I'm ashamed to admit, really didn't know about the cultural Cold War. I had a vague idea that the CIA was backing. I mean, I knew about the money flowing to the little magazines. I had no idea about the publishing business. I worked with some of the people, in my youth, with some of the people I've been talking about here in the publishing houses, and I then became intrigued that, you know, the moral conundrum. First of all, you didn't see the CIA as an evil force, and you did worry about the Soviets. And, I mean, you had people like Mary McCarthy. She was never paid by the CIA, but they knew there was CIA backing, and they certainly knew there was CIA backing to a lot of the conferences and that sort of thing. The joke was, whether the CIA got its money's worth or not is another question entirely, but the joke was you had writers and artists who couldn't afford bus fare to Newark flying first class to India. And it was pretty hard, you know, to resist this sort of thing. Yes, Richard. According to the things I've never interviewed him. According to the books I've read, he knew, and he was very patriotic, and he thought, yeah. And so he thought, you know, this was. No, he didn't. I nowhere have I seen that he was on their payroll or anything like that. He just probably cooperated, and the kind of. It's like Hunt in the Mysteries. You know, how much propaganda can you get into a mystery? A lot. You know, that you sneak these ideas in and we begin to see. Well, actually, one I haven't talked about is Mickey Spillane. And he apparently, I don't know that the CIA paid him. I don't think I ever came across that. But his bad guys gradually, you'll have anybody here who's a Mickey Spillane fan will have to tell me if I'm right about this. It's secondary knowledge here, secondary information. His bad guys went from being just criminals, maybe they were Nazis during the war, from being criminals to being Reds. And so I think that probably Michener would just, you know, he believed it, so he'd put in some scenes with very evil communists.
And wouldn't that have been in the comic books for the 8-year-old?
Yeah, exactly. Actually, that's an interesting point, though. Nowhere in the research did I come across the CIA funding comic books. Yeah, I'm sure the CIA wouldn't miss the opportunity. They probably thought of this, and were probably doing it. Yes. I'm sorry. Yes. That was the other side. That was McCarthyism. Not the other side, but when all the libraries in foreign countries, they were cleaning those out. They certainly would not fund somebody like Faulkner. They wouldn't get behind him. And I'm trying to remember now, because I did the research a long time ago. There were ways, you know, we will discourage putting these books in foreign libraries. But the main one, the most interesting case, is Richard Wright. Now, Richard Wright was a communist in the 30s, and he left the party. And he then began to cooperate with the CIA. And then he had a falling out with the CIA, and by this time he was living in Paris. He died under very strange circumstances. And all the biographies of him cite this. He was in the hospital. He had been ill. He called the nurse for something. He was laughing and joking with her. She gave him a drink or his meds or something like this. He called her an hour later, and by the time she got there, he was dead. And it was not clear. And then he was taken to he was in a clinic, not the hospital. He was taken to a very strange morgue of some sort in France. And his friends insist that he was murdered by either the communists or the CIA. Many of them say the CIA. Now, the friend who was most passionate about this was an African-American cartoonist who ended up going to live in East Berlin. He renounced his American citizenship. So I don't think anybody knows what happened to Richard Wright, but they were, and also in the conferences they held around the world, they would not invite these writers that showed, as I said, the seamy, what they considered the seamy side of life, American life. Yes, John.
Do you have any sense yourself whether this worked?
No, that's what I mean about the CIA not getting its money's worth. They spent a lot of money, and it's not quite clear that that it made any difference. I mean, something like the book, the Penkovsky papers. Did we really need someone to tell us by this time that, you know, the Soviet system could be pretty brutal with spies and, you know, about spy, this sort of thing? I haven't read, put it this way, I haven't read anyone who has said, yes, it had a serious effect on the country. Yeah. Yes?
Did it have a serious effect on literature? I mean, did anything
that's another good question. Or anything bad. That again is an interesting question. We'll never know the answer to. I mean, in my novel, which obviously is fictional, the editor of a little magazine finds himself shading things without meaning to, and this I've talked to people who were approached by the CIA, and that was one of their fears, that the CIA wouldn't come in if you were an editor and say, you know, you do this, we break your kneecaps. You'd know that they were reading and keeping an eye out. And maybe without even meaning to, you'd begin to shade your coverage. And I think that was the danger, the subtlety more than anything overt. They did, the CIA funded, of course, the National Student Association, and that apparently was pretty effective. And it's well known, I don't know if she's ever admitted it, Gloria Steinem, no, she has admitted it, because I've read interviews, Gloria Steinem, was I don't know if she was paid. She was cooperating with the CIA for the National Student Association. And she goes on record as saying, this was during the Kennedy administration, and these were some of the most liberal people I knew, the CIA agents. So it's interesting. Yes, Carla. So we have an unwitting person in our midst. There you have it. Yes. These aren't so much. They're kind of a mix of people, and they. They grew, I'm happy to say they grew while I was working. I mean, because if they don't, you've got a dead novel on your hands. but they weren't real characters. Yes?
You mentioned McCarthyism. Do you see any connection between this and the whole McCarthy?
Oh, yeah. The CIA and the FBI hated each other, and there was a tremendous competition. And in the novel, the character who's cooperating with the CIA is called down to Washington and grilled by the FBI. And that, in fact, is based on the grilling of Julia Child's husband, who was, when he worked for the State Department, he was called home. There's some of this in the movie. He's called home and grilled. And the CIA told the character in the book, don't worry, we have to let them call you in, but we'll cover your back. And definitely... you know, they were overlapping. But as I said, there was plenty of right-wing anti-Soviet propaganda here. What they needed, they felt, was left-wing. And it was true, because you had dyed-in-the-wool communists, who even after the war were still communists. And then you had left-leaning anti-Stalinists. And they were instrumental in this. And again, that's Mary McCarthy. Yes. That's the question in the book. And if you go into this, and you're not allowed to tell anyone, I mean, the CIA used eternal confidentiality, and you're not allowed to tell anyone. The CIA agent, or bureau chief I spoke to, the one who was throughout his arms, we're proud of it, he told me, he said he believed that anybody should get out of the intelligence business after a particular length of time. He said it's such a difficult way to live, and he said it really makes you quite crazy. And he said for his sanity, he left because of some things he didn't like that the CIA were doing, but he also left, he said, because it was, he just couldn't live that way anymore.
Do you have any comments on Mr. Firth, who is a light factory turning out fiction?
On Mr. I'm sorry. First, who's writing now?
Alan First, right?
Alan First, yeah.
Yeah. He's on number 20 and 25.
Yeah, you have a big First fan here. I mean, this is past CIA infiltration. Yeah.
But it's Andy, it's late 30s. So
yeah, that's the period he's writing about. Yeah, but
that's always the era that he's most fascinated.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But the British are allowed.
So one more, or is that it? Yes. I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
What research project are you planning on next?
Margaret Sanger. Completely different. Yes, a nice change. Not that this wasn't great fun. Thank you all very much. Yeah.